From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour began with a tongue, a hummingbird's tongue, to be specific. Have you ever wondered how hummingbirds drink nectar from flowers? Scientists in the 1800s thought they knew, but it turns out they were wrong. In 1833, scientists proposed a theory for the process. They said the tongues divide in two at the outer edges to create two side-by-side tubes. Those tubes, they said, passively draw liquid into themselves, a process called capillary action. The same term describes how water soaks into a paper towel. But when it comes to hummingbirds, it turns out this explanation was incorrect. It took the work of a graduate student who used high-speed macro photography and resourcefulness to uncover the truth. Alejandro Rico Guevara shared his work with the team behind the PBS show Nature, and here's what they learned in their words. Quote, hummingbirds' long tongues have four tips that open as they dip into the nectar. A fringe of tiny filaments uncurls along the edges of the open tips, creating grooves that spring open, filling the tongue with nectar. End quote. The tongues are as thin as a fishing line and can lap nectar at a rate of 20 times a second. For nature lovers to see this process on video is remarkable, and it was made possible in part by the producers and filmmakers of Nature. The episode earned an Emmy in 2017 for outstanding cinematography. You can watch Nature every Wednesday evening on WXXI-TV, and this hour you're going to hear from the executive producer, from a filmmaker. They're in Rochester to discuss their new series, American Spring Alive, which premieres on WXXI-TV in late April. We'll get a preview of that series, and we'll discuss how you can kind of become a citizen scientist and assist scientists around the world with data collection. I'd like to welcome our guests for the hour who are part of an event tonight that I am sad to tell you at the Little Theater is already sold out. But Fred Kaufman, the executive producer of Nature, I don't know if you were joking. You said maybe a second screen. Fred, don't commit to this. The public's going to demand more screenings.
And we will respond because the idea of somebody not being able to come to our presentation tonight, first of all, stuns me.
But speaks to your popularity.
Well, thrilled to be here. You know, when we do speak about nature and natural history and how films are made, people are really curious and interested. And it's always a fun and informative evening.
Well, we're thrilled to have you here, and it is sold out tonight, but no worries. That's why we're here on WXXI-TV on Wednesday nights. Ann Johnson Prum is senior producer of American Spring Live and an award-winning filmmaker, and it's great to have you, Ann. Thank you for being here.
It's great to be here.
And also with us is Betsy Youkiridis, who is an environmental educator for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. WXXI is partnering with the New York State DEC in a number of nature-related initiatives in which you can participate. We'll learn more about that this hour. Thank you for being here.
It's a joy.
Well, you know, Fred, our colleagues were raving about all of you downstairs earlier. We were getting ready for the program. I know you've been, at least we hope you've been enjoying your stay in Rochester. And I want to step back a little bit and just kind of ask you, for our listeners who have not tuned in to see Nature yet, what they can expect on Wednesday evenings from WXXI-TV.
Oh, my God. It's really just an eclectic mix of what you would consider to be traditional animal wildlife documentaries and very interesting and unique relationships between people and animals, conservation stories, environmental stories, all sorts of, you know, quality, worthwhile, detailed, observational films. I was saying earlier, it takes usually 2 to 3 years to make a nature film. And it's not unlikely for somebody like Ann to spend 2 weeks in a jungle to get a sequence that's going to last 40 seconds on air. So to flip that and now do 3 nights of live nature television, for us, it's using completely different muscles, and who knows how this is going to turn out, because, you know, we could shoot 1,000 hours to make a 1-hour documentary, and come late April, we're going to have 1 hour to make a 1-hour show.
Amazing. Well, the premiere of American Spring Live is April 29th. It's going to run April 29th through May 1st on WXXI TV. And you know, building on Fred's point on how different this format is going to be, what's the challenge as you see it, and how would you sort of preview it for our listeners?
Well, the challenge is that we're going to be shooting animals live. And for anybody who's a nature observer, that's incredibly difficult and unpredictable. So we've tried to put ourselves and our cameras in places where we can, with a certain amount of hope get animals live. For instance, we're going to Bracken Cave, which is the largest gathering of mammals in the New World. So there are millions and millions of bats there. So we're pretty sure that they're going to be there, and they're going to show up, and we'll be there for the emergence of those bats, and we'll learn about why that all those bats are in that cave.
And then the follow-up is, you know, if you spend 2 weeks in an area looking for 40 seconds of a shot, for looking for this perfect moment, waiting for these dramatic scenes that can take a while. I mean, the animals are not waiting for your cue. You've got to be patient. Why do it live this way? Why did you want to do it?
Well, I think the idea is that, you know, as the television landscape gets kind of fractured, that we wanted to have an event. This is like the Olympics of spring. So we're trying to get viewers to tune in 8 o'clock, three nights in a row, and really get a sense of how spring is marching across America and what animals do in response to that.
How did you decide where to go?
We basically, our first challenge was when in spring were we going to film this? Because spring changes across America. And we zeroed in on these three nights as basically the sort of comfort zone where we have birds showing up, beginning nesting, we have monarch butterflies starting to lay eggs, bats migrating, bobcats out in fields starting to look for prey to feed their young.
Well, and I'm just reading a little bit about some of the work that, you know, some of the either suggestions from viewers or even the notion of citizen scientists. There's going to be a strong social media component. So let's talk a little bit about what people can do. And in a moment, we'll ask Betsy, because WXXI wants people to help sort of become citizen scientists here, and we'll talk a little bit about that. What are you hoping for in terms of interaction with the audience with this?
Well, we're going to have five different citizen science projects mm-hmm. in the 3 hours. And those were very carefully picked, working with Cornell Lab of Ornithology, who are the leaders in citizen science. And we really want to move, our mantra right now at WNET Nature is, you know, moving viewers to doers. And we want to help viewers find projects where they can go out after watching our shows and get involved in their local communities to help scientists record spring.
How connected to your audience do you feel, Fred?
Oh, very much so. I think anybody works in public television, and if you're executive producing a strand, there's a bond and an expectation with the audience different from anywhere else. First of all, they're members. They give money to what we're doing. So from my perspective, there's a huge responsibility to feel that whatever we're doing is worthy, is deserving of people going into their pockets and giving us $40, $80, $100 a year. And we hear from them and we hear their comments. And what we know that they appreciate is really good heavy duty science, you know, the expression dumb things down or make it entertaining or make it commercial. Mm-hmm. And people who watch nature don't want that. I mean, they really want a level of science that even surprises me. And when we're talking about American Spring Live and we're talking about what location and what behaviors and what we're going to see, on a higher level, we're talking about some fairly rich scientific themes. One of them is climate change, which we're seeing all the time, and that's affecting how animals behave and when they show up. So when we talk about migrations, this is all influenced by when spring appears and whether it's early or late and wherever you are. There's a thing called phenology, which I never even heard of, and I'm guessing you've never heard of it. Mm. And I'll give you the real thumbnail description of that. But spring is all about timing. Longer days, warmer days trigger growth, which trigger animals coming out of hibernation, which triggers pollination. There's a series of events that need to happen for the animals to feed and for things to happen. Again, because of climate change, if any one of those things happens late or doesn't happen at all, there's a reaction to it. So it's important people understand how that all connects as well. Then there's good old-fashioned animal behavior, which we want to talk about. And then there's things citizen science, which is huge in the scientific community, basically boiling down to this. You can't have a scientist everywhere. So if we can get viewers to go online and follow certain relatively simple protocols of what information could help scientists, we can gather and have a more complete picture about what's going on in the natural world, where animals are moving, what migrations are like, where they're showing up, and what their behaviors are. And particularly for the public television audience, they love this kind of stuff. I mean, they want to be outside. They want to help. They want to contribute. So we think it's really going to resonate with them.
I mean, the work of citizen scientists has impacted what we know about our world and far beyond our own world, even in recent years. It was a couple of years ago now, a Yale postdoc was asking for citizen science research help in monitoring the brightness and the dimness of stars. And that's when they found what we called Tabby's star, which was Tabitha Boyajian, this is a Yale postdoc, with the help of citizen scientists, found the strangest dimming pattern to the point where we thought maybe this isn't like an alien superstructure surrounding the star. Unfortunately, probably not aliens, it turns out, but a fascinating way of just trying to understand what's actually happening. And that took citizen science work. So I thought that was fascinating. What are some of the things that that people are going to help you with, Fred?
Well, we feature five long-term citizen science projects. One is Track a Lilac, where you're asked to make notations because lilacs sort of...
We call them lilacs here. I don't know why in Rochester.
What do I say?
You are contractually obligated in Rochester to call them lilacs.
Well, not only am I from New York, but I'm from the Bronx.
So I know it's a lilac. I'm from Cleveland. It's still lilac to me. But
makes it even worse.
But so go ahead.
Asking citizen scientists to make notations about when they see lilacs. We have something called Bird Cam Labs, or Bird Cam's Lab. Let me amend that from Cornell. This is really interesting. People have seen kind of locked off streaming video of cameras on bird nests, and it's very interesting to watch. It's sort of hypnotic. And, you know, people just play them on their desktop at work. But again, you're asked to make notations on certain things. One project is called Battling Birds. People have seen this all the time. Let's say you're at a bird feeder or something. A bird comes in, and the bird that's already there gets startled and flies off. That's called displacement. Scientists actually want to know more about that, and so they're going to ask you to make notations when that happens. The great thing about watching this video, if you're elderly, if you're infirm, if you can't get out, if you can't go to the park, if you know, you're really not physically able, or even if you just don't want to, you could make contributions to science simply sitting at your dining room table watching these videos and recording what's going on. So there's something for everybody, from being very simple to slightly harder protocols. But as you said, you know, you could really make a contribution to our understanding, maybe change local laws. You know, build on the database already existing. It's actually a big deal. And I'm sure it's going to appeal to a certain segment of the viewership, whether it's parents wanting to go with their children or grandparents with their grandchildren, et cetera. It's very important in the scientific community to get involved.
Well, what do you want to see people get involved with here with the DEC, Betsy?
Well, there's a number of citizen science projects that the DEC does. With WXXI and DEC's partnership, we're promoting SciStarter.org, which is a database or warehouse, as I like to call it, of a bunch of citizen science projects that have family, library, after-school programs that you can run, simple ones all the way up to super hard ones, computerized ones, getting outside ones, and a platform called iNaturalist.org as well, to help get people outside, because we are the DEC, we'd like you to get outside. But with iNat, like most people of us call it, we're using iNat to do a month-long nature challenge to help promote viewers in the entire WXXI viewing area to get outside and take observations of plants, animals, insects, whatever they see, not domestic, and just put them, it'll automatically, if they're in the project, it's April 1st through April 30th, and it'll automatically put them in our nature challenge for the viewer area. Along with that, the zoo is doing the International City Challenge, which is only one weekend at the end of April, so it'll kind of be a combination. And it'll help Rochester compete against international cities in the International City Nature Challenge. So there's a number of ways. We're also doing a family fishing festival April 13th at Powder Mills Park. And that helps with the DEC because it gets people, families interested in fishing. And one of our big citizen science projects for the DEC is angler diaries. It's how we see what fish are out in what lakes, who's fishing where, when they're catching them, part of the phenology, so that we can see if there's if they're not being able to fish in certain areas, they're not catching what they used to catch. So that's how we like to check what's available in the lakes and streams. And Finger Lakes is one area that we have low angler diary, and we'd like to see more people filling out angler diaries.
Okay, so how, again, how to get involved? What's the best way to do it?
Reach out to our regional office in the Avon area for this part of the state, and talk to our regional fisheries biologist.
There's a lot we want to talk about this hour when it comes to how our guests put together the programming that they've created for you. Before we dive back into that, Matthew just wants to know, Evan, are your guests worried that climate change is changing the very work that they're doing, and what changes are they seeing that they didn't used to see? That's from Matthew. It's a good question. I'd probably both of you can hit that.
Yeah, Matthew, great question. One of the motivating reasons we're doing this Spring Live is, as Fred said, we really want to know more about climate change. And this big word, phenology, is really the study of spring and how and the arrival of spring. And there's a 50-year study. This Lilac Watch Citizen Science Project has been going on for 50 years, and they are seeing that lilacs are blooming earlier in the year. Mm-hmm. The growing season is getting longer. And so what impact does that have on the rest of the natural world? When we see a change just in lilacs, it's obviously happening in a lot of plants out there.
I think one of the assumptions that people like me make is, well, in terms of growing, especially in upstate New York, that's a good thing. Take the wine industry. You get a longer growing season. You can get riper grapes. But then you talk to growers and they say, it's not just a longer growing season. It's more volatility. So if we get an earlier bud break, we're also dealing with an extended window for possible frost that could wipe out half or an entire season, a full vintage, just because things warmed earlier. But really, we weren't kind of ready for that. Do you see volatility? In other words, does it seem like a much more complex process than maybe the lay people like us assume?
Well, we have the advantage of traveling all across the country and all across the world. And what I'm hearing more and more is like, this has been a really weird dot, dot, dot.
Whether it's the word really weird a lot?
Weird a lot. Whether it's a weird summer, a weird fall, a weird winter, a weird spring, that people are feeling this volatility and things aren't the same as they used to be. And when you start hearing that from people in very different kinds of habitats, in the mountains, in the Everglades, in Florida, it seems like we're dealing with change and things are not like they used to be.
Fred, what would you say about maybe some of the change you have observed?
Well, just to really echo what Ann had said, which is it's hard now to budget and schedule our films because, as I said earlier, you might give yourself 2 to 3 weeks to film some behavior out west, only to find you get somewhere and somebody says, oh, you should have been here last week. That's when it all happened. And so, you know, things like migrations and where animals are showing up and what's happening, sort of the interactions with these animals are either, you know, off kilt, they're out of sync, or they're not happening, or they're happening earlier than expected, or they're happening later than expected. And as you said, well, you know, there's somebody somewhere saying, whoa, wait a minute, spring's coming earlier, great, you know, less winter, more spring. But it's much more complicated, it's much more intricate, and if it's good for somebody or something, it's probably bad for something else.
Betsy, what do you see in this regard?
It's also the extremities. Mm-hmm. You see a lot more extremes rather than just the normal rain periods, the normal winter periods. You'll see snow coming in November and October, but not then you'll have warmth periods in December and January. Then you'll start having snows again and coldness in February, March. We're below average for temperature right now.
Right.
Normally we have a warmer pre-spring. But it's that extremities that are really causing some of the problems, especially with the growing seasons. If you can't rely on a good snowpack and then all of a sudden to recharge your water aquifer, and then you have no rain during August when it's your hottest month, all of your crops are now burning in the fields.
Hmm. Well, let's kind of work through some of how nature comes together. Listeners, if you're just joining us, our guests here are in Rochester talking about an event tonight at the Little Theater. I would tell you all about it, but then you'd really want to go, and you'd be very disappointed to find out it's already sold out. But American Spring Live is coming your way April 29th through May 1st on WXXI-TV. And, of course, you know PBS Nature on Wednesday nights here. And I do want to ask our guests, Fred and Ann, specifically, if, you know, so much of what you're doing is telling stories, these compelling, powerful stories with the images, with the care that you have in the spring program that's live. You're putting a lot of work into being prepared to kind of tell the story in a live setting. So much of your work over the years has been the painstaking project of creating for Wednesday nights, for us at Wednesday nights. Do you want your viewers to be conservationists? Do you want them to love nature in the way you do? Do you have a goal beyond just presenting compelling stories? Did you have something that you're hoping comes out of it, Fred?
You know, really, no. And I get asked that question, you know, what do you want viewers to get out? What is the lesson? And I always feel I'm not at the level to have that expectation with people. We try to put on an entertaining show.
It has to be entertaining first, right?
I think so. It has to be entertaining, hold your interest, be informative, you know, work with all the tools that we have, whether it be footage and script and music. And I think of myself sort of as an artisan, you know, just kind of constructing this and pacing it. Does it make sense? Is it holding my interest? And what people get out of these films, to me, is very personal. I mean, there's somebody who's watching it on a Wednesday night and it's just lowering their blood pressure and they're not watching cable news and they go, that's good enough for me. And there's somebody who has a bird who will have a tremendous interest in a hummingbird film and they're looking at completely different than somebody else. So you know, whatever you get out of it works. If it's just background noise, that works. As long as you feel that it's worthy and interesting to you, that satisfies me.
Yeah?
I clearly want to change the world. I have a little bit different mission than Fred. I'm very mission-driven. I want people to tune into the shows that I make and feel that they want to get involved with saving the natural world, understanding the natural world, and committing some part of their lives to conservation and environmental education. So, yeah, I mean, that's what inspires me. We spend a lot of time on these films in my crews, and I think we all feel the same way, that we are very mission-driven.
You know, it's interesting, though, because when you think about that it's got to be entertaining first, probably the same would be said of this talk show. People wouldn't tune in if they didn't enjoy it in some fashion. Mm-hmm. But when I took over hosting in 2014, the first day we just had people let me know, what are you interested in? And we had multiple calls from people saying, do not be afraid of complex science. Do not be afraid of complex issues. Do not feel like you have to always distill and dumb down. And I thought that was really important right out of the gate for me as sort of to bolster this notion that too often we create too narrow a range for what is either entertaining or acceptable, that people can be entertained by complexity and beauty that's slow and not loud and not always in your face. Though, of course, there are moments in nature where it's very much so. But do you agree with that, Fred, that maybe the traditional media notion, the consultants who would tell you, are maybe missing the public's appetite for complexity?
Oh, God, I absolutely agree, and particularly on PBS, where I think there is even that expectation. And if you don't meet that expectation, you get criticized for it. And we've gotten criticized for maybe kind of overdoing the animal character in our films and maybe giving it kind of a human characteristics, maybe a little too much. You know, maybe we find doing that helps the story and helps the audience relate. And sometimes we hear from people saying, you know, you don't need to do that. You shouldn't be doing that. And so, you know, sometimes you step over the line and you come back. I mean, you're always sort of tweaking, you know, where the needle goes on how much content to impart to the viewer. And frankly, if it is complicated, you know, for me, when you know, television to me is like sightseeing in a moving car. You see something and then you're off and you're seeing something again. And how much do you spoon out when you see something? Because you can't dwell on it for too long. But I think with what we do, we might convey a complex thought. Then the viewer would need to really take some time to then look up and Google and spend some time to better understand it. But at least let's put it out there for them to hear and for them to pursue.
Okay. Anne?
Yeah. Excuse me. I think that science is pretty much the motivator for when we start to build a film or start to think about a film. We're researching and reading articles about science, and we stand on the shoulders of scientists. We can't make these shows without either going in the field with scientists and presenting their work, or they might not even appear on camera, but we're presenting the animals that they're working on. So I think that science is really cool, and I think that the public is insatiable in their wanting of it. And I mean, I meet viewers who tell me, God, I never knew that before about hummingbirds or butterflies or whatever. And that's the motivator. I want to show people, I want them to, when they stop watching the show, the show's over, to say, wow, I never knew that. And now I do. And I think once you have that information and you go out and you see a hummingbird after you've watched one of our shows or a butterfly, you'll look at it a little bit differently. And you might, you'll have a richer and deeper understanding of that animal.
One of the challenges we face all the time is about climate change, which is hugely important, but as producers, impossible to tell that story visually. How do you show climate change? You know, you take a picture from 10 years ago and show a current, and that's kind of the extent of it. So it's a very hard concept to come across visually. It's not dramatic. You can't run out on, you know, sunrise or sunset and said, hey, give me a beautiful picture of climate change here. Mm-hmm. So it's a challenge to even figure out how to convey that and how much time to give to it when it's not in front of your face. It doesn't show itself.
Betsy, as an educator, how do you view the importance of understanding how to reach the public but not ignoring maybe their appetite and capacity for embracing complexity?
Well, it's all about reading the audience and understanding that how the development of the brain goes. I mean, we, as a general education, early childhood up until about the fourth grade, they're very concrete thinkers. So anything, climate change is not beyond them per se, but it's, they'll relate it back. There's a great, I hate to say article, but article all about a second grader who learned about saving the elephants to protect them from ivory. And it's all about don't buy ivory soap. It's literally don't buy it, because that's what the concept that they knew about was ivory soap in their brains. So they went home and they learned all about saving the elephants from ivory poachers. And the only thing that they could conceptualize because of the concrete examples in their brains, and that's how they could relate that complex topic, was going home and telling their parents they couldn't buy ivory soap anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's a 20-year-old example, but it's still perfect because a lot of these complex, abstract things are too broad for them to contemplate mm-hmm. and really bring down to their world. So climate change is something we usually bring in about fourth grade. So understanding their developmental practices at that point, but also understanding that the audience, where they are in the education land, and watching their faces as you learn and do the project and whatever you're presenting is really the key. If you can keep them engaged, make sure that it's hands-on and fun, but they're learning something and they want to come back and learn more, that's when you know you've got them. But you also want to make sure that they're actually learning what you want them to learn.
Sure.
So you have to make sure that balance is always there.
No, soap is relatable. Ice cream's relatable. My son's 7. He gets National Geographic Kids, and they mention when you go out for ice cream, get the cone. Don't get the plastic spoons to go with it, because too much plastic ends up in a landfill or the ocean. And mm-hmm. there's all these images and pictures, and he's going, that's a plastic mass? I'm saying, yes. And he goes, well, ice cream is now related to that. You know,
yep.
So clever ways of relating at different audiences, different levels. I think the team at Nature is just remarkable with what they do. I know our listeners do as well. That's why they've sold out tonight's event at the Little Theater. And I know that you're going to enjoy American Spring Live, which is coming your way April 29th through May 1st on WXXI TV. April 29th through May 1st. So mark your calendars. It's like watching you know, the World Series of American Nature, spring unfolding across the country before our eyes, and I would not want to have to be producing that. It's an amazing task. We're going to take our only break of the hour, and when we come back, we're going to work in more of the listener feedback. So listeners, I've got some emails to share from you. You've got questions for the creators of this series, this award-winning series, and well-deserved, with Fred Kaufman, Ann Johnson Prum, Betsy Youkeritis from the New York State DEC. Let's get that break, and we'll come right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, understanding the state of gun laws and legislation. Post-Parkland, what about armed security officers in school? How often do we see it? What does the law say? What has changed? And you might have heard about the red flag gun bill proposal. We're talking about removing guns from people who might be deemed a threat. We'll discuss it Thursday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So Ann Johnson Prum, who is the senior producer of American Spring Live, an award-winning filmmaker, I would think that one of the great challenges in your line of work and Fred's line of work, when you're trying to create these images, the video, the stories of nature, is to get close enough to do it authentically without disturbing the environment or sort of disrupting the routines, the habits, or just your presence being felt by the animals themselves. What is that the interplay like? How do you do that? Are you very good at being covert?
Exactly. We're very good at being covert. And really, we've spent a lot of time with animals. And if we overstep, then the behavior doesn't happen, right? If the animal is stressed or feels our presence or decides just doesn't want to be around us, we don't get any footage. So it's within our best interests to stay back and listen and observe the animal and just work with it. And at the same time, we have a code of ethics of not disturbing or interfering with anything the animal would naturally be doing. And that's just a code of ethics that we personally have developed over years, myself and my crew, and I know nature supports that as well. So we're not going to do anything that's sort of unethical or disturbs the behavior.
Fred?
Yeah, you know, sort of the mantra we live by, which is safety is number one. So you never want to put yourself in a position where you're in danger by being too close to the animal, or the animal's in danger because it gets spooked by you and behaves abnormally. The other thing we do is we work from blinds, which is basically a disguised tent. And so we'll put a camouflage tent, let's say, in a forest a week before we film. So the animals living there slowly get used to seeing this thing, but they know it doesn't move and it's not a threat. And they just kind of walk around it. And then, you know, before dawn, one morning, a camera person will go into that tent, set up their camera, and be able to record natural behavior very close to the animals. It depends where you work. In Africa, it's very easy to get close to animals. And in other places, if you're in a jungle, you'll hear the animals, particularly the birds, but you won't see them. But the people who make these films are so skilled, and they have such great intuition, knowing where to stand, where to be, what time of the day. A lot of work with scientists. You know, they really inform us where you want to be. I mean, all these things really begin with the scientists. There's somebody studying something somewhere. The science is just absolutely phenomenal with having great background information about where to locate yourself, at what time of the day, what time of the year, what to expect. So, you know, a lot of resources, but really, I think number one is the intuition camera people have. Mm-hmm. They just, it's in their DNA. They kind of know where to be. And, you know, I would get there and I'd make an absolute mess. And there's a story of a producer friend of mine. They were tracking elephants in Africa to film, and they could never get close to them. And they would drive up, and the elephants would just drift away all day. They were doing this. It was so frustrating. Finally, by the end of the day, they were able to get close enough to get great shots. And the cameraman got out, and the assistant got out, and the producer, who was sitting in the back, got out of the vehicle and absentmindedly slammed the door behind him. And the elephants moved off again.
Oh, no.
So, anything could trigger that kind of disturbance. And oh my God, how awful.
I do appreciate your shining the light on the entire team of people, the people behind the camera who have that intuition. And I like to remind listeners of this program, if this ever sounds good, and it does every day, that's Rob Braden. Or anything that's really remarkable that happens on the Connections, that's Megan Mack. It really is a team of people. And there must be moments, I'm sure the door slam sticks out in your mind, but there must also be moments where you're going, I can't believe I'm seeing this, or this is so beautiful. You must be witnessing these moments that just take your breath away at times, too.
Yeah, well, I'll let Anne answer that because she has more experience. But I've even asked camera people, you're up in the Himalayas, you just spent 3 weeks looking for a snow leopard, finally you see one. How does your hand not shake when you're operating the camera? Yeah. I mean, how do you have the poise to stay still and the wherewithal to know? Because when you're shooting, you not only do you need to stay still, but do you zoom in? Do you zoom out? Do you move the camera to the right so you have the shot of the animal walking into the frame? Because you're also now thinking, holy, I got this. But I got to think, how is it going to edit? So I need pieces to this. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how they do it because your heart's pumping. And, you know, wherever you are, it's either freezing or blistering hot. And to have that poise. And I mean, you've shot hummingbirds and ducks. And, you know, what you see through that lens, oh, my God, it's extraordinary. When you have a hummingbird the size of your thumb, but it's a foot away and it's taking up, you know, the entire screen of your viewfinder. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think all people who work on the production side of this are sort of adrenaline junkies. And the adrenaline we get is from capturing wildlife, waiting for weeks for it to come. And then when it comes, it is the biggest thrill you can imagine. I mean, your hands are shaking after you turn the camera off. And knowing that what you've just seen and what you've been able to capture is going to go in the show is, you know it when you shoot it, that that's going in the show because it's just perfect. The lighting is perfect. The behavior was perfect. You've been waiting for it to come. And now you've got it in the can.
I've also heard from camera people shooting particularly dangerous scenes that somehow when you're looking at an elephant charging you through a viewfinder, it feels less real than if you were just standing there. They somehow, foolishly, they think there's this buffer.
Oh, yeah.
When there isn't.
Step away. Yeah. But, and you step away and you look and go, oh, we got to get out of here.
Yeah, exactly. Until they get that shot, they just stand there.
Rob wants to know, how do they get the sound of the wings buzzing of the hummingbirds, asking for an audio engineering friend?
we record a lot of audio in the field, wild tracks, wild sound. When we're shooting in high speed, we can't shoot sync sound. So we shoot a lot of, using a parabola, we record to a remote recorder. And then we come back and we actually build tracks as well, audio tracks. We sweeten them, just like you would in a feature film. So if the hummingbird is moving its wings very slowly, we have a sound mixer and who's foleying a lot of those sounds. He'll use maybe a wet towel to give you that at high speed. So we always make sure there's integrity in that, that these are sounds that we would normally be hearing. We're not putting anything that is unnatural. When we put in bird calls from that area, we are very scrupulous and make sure that those birds are in that area. I go to the movies. My husband's an ornithologist, and he's constantly going, that bird doesn't occur here in that scene in Africa. So we're pretty careful about that stuff.
Hmm. I imagine there's all kinds of fact checkers.
If you put in the wrong bird.
Your audience will tell you, right?
Oh, my. They delight in that. Yeah. They love to point out if we mislabel the species or.
Especially birders.
Oh, birders love it. I mean.
They caught us.
Wait a second. They love to call you out, but are they kind about it?
Not always.
Not always. You'd be surprised that you could tell there's such delight in feeling like
they know
something.
Well, it's always a backhanded compliment. Like, you do such good work, but.
You do know that's the wrong bird song.
Now, Super Hummingbirds won an Emmy for Outstanding Cinematography a couple of years ago. And, you know, you'd covered hummingbirds on the series before. So how do you decide, we're going to come back, this is what we want to do for the, do you have a whiteboard? Listeners of this program may not know this, but in my office there's a whiteboard. We call it the Bob, B-A-W-B. I'm not going to explain what that term is, but the last two is whiteboard. And there's lots of ideas for program topics, lots of different categories. Is there a Bob in your offices with lots of show ideas for nature, for American Spring Live, places you want to go, things you want to do or do again? Yeah?
Well, anything we want to do, we do. So there isn't a list of things we want to do that we're not doing. Whenever, you know, I had a bug in my head that we had to do a film on squirrels. I just felt I've been seeing them. I'm fascinated by them. Let's do a film on squirrels. And we did. So anything we want to do, we end up doing. But you're right. We've been on the air for 37 years. We've done everything. So what warrants coming back to redo? Two things, I think. In the case of the work that Anne does, it's always some technical innovation that makes what we're going to see look fresh and new. You know, new developments with cameras and lenses and other devices where all of a sudden I'm seeing, you know, a hummingbird that looks the size of Godzilla. And I see detail now that I haven't seen before. So that warrants going back. Or if somebody has a wonderful story, it's a personal story. I had heard about an orphaned elephant that was being reintroduced to a herd, and there were wonderful little story elements to this. It was almost like a true-to-life Disney film. And, you know, we've done elephants dozens of times, but this particular story was so engaging and the character so interesting, it was worth going back to do.
Hmm. What do you want to see them do more of, Betsy? You got their ear now.
I don't know.
Bears.
Actually, people and wildlife living, how they live together would probably be a good one. Or maybe not the conflicts and how to prevent conflicts, because it's much easier to teach a human than it is to teach wildlife.
Well, we have emails on the subject sort of conflict in a couple different directions here, so that's a good segue, because Annie says, big fan, thank you, see you tonight. Also wanted to say, my four-year-old likes to look at shows like this and say, nature is mean. That's from Annie. Annie, thank you. My son watches this and goes, boy, nature can be violent. It can be. It can be really brutal at times.
You know, I was talking about this earlier. There's been such an incredible increase in sensitivity toward what we're seeing on nature shows.
Oh, that's interesting.
And 35 years ago, we had no problem showing a number of predation kills. And in fact, you know, it was always the high point because it's so dramatic when you watch animals stalk another animal. Particularly big cats. I mean, you see.
I'm watching this going like, run, go. They're here. They see you. Go. Don't go there. It's like watching a horror film. You're like, don't go in there.
Right.
What are you doing?
Yeah, so.
It's tough to watch.
We used to do a lot of that, really no problem. But today, there's tremendous sensitivity about any kind of predation. And I got to tell you, what we show is so watered down from what really happened. And how horrific it really is in nature. I was in Botswana in December, and we saw a lioness take a warthog. And it took 15 minutes for that warthog to die.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, an other lioness, I see you making a face, you don't like this.
I'm a little squeamish.
Okay. And the other lioness that was with her starts eating the animal.
While it's still alive?
While it's still alive.
I mean, that's rude. You can at least wait.
So... what really, now in a show, that would all be over in seconds, but it was a 15 to 20 minute ordeal. And personally, I always root for the predator, because if the predators are doing well, that means there's a healthy ecosystem.
No, that's fair.
But yes, you're right. People are very sensitive to this, and I still don't understand how somebody could watch a lion or a big predator film and be surprised that there was a predation in the film. You know, they want a heads up. You know, they want me
to... Do you get complaints?
Yeah.
Okay, interesting. So because as much as I am squeamish, I would never complain. In fact, I think it's vital that we see it. I think it's seeing nature as it is, as much as we can, matters.
Well, sometimes they want us to prevent something from happening, which we can't do and wouldn't do, or they want to know why we showed it, or they want to know why they were sitting there with their six-year-old and there wasn't a warning before it happened. I mean, you know, you know, there's a greater heightened sensitivity today than ever before.
Hmm. Does that bother you, Anne?
Which part?
The sensitivity, the complaints.
No, I think that, people are entitled to feel what they feel. I think that Nature, the series on PBS, handles this stuff very carefully and with a lot of integrity. There's a lot of cable programs that it's much more tooth and claw, what I would call, where they really want to promote this idea that, you know, nature, this versus this. Personally, I don't do a lot of predator-prey in my shows. I do things, I feel like there's too much emphasis in that in a lot of wildlife programming. And I try to do shows that are about more subtleties, about smaller things in nature. My hummingbirds, they did prey on insects, so that was a prey scene, but it was a little bit different.
Shouldn't bother us, though, right? Seeing nature. I take Anne's point that some of these series on other networks are a little kind of dramatized, you know, sensationalized, mm-hmm. This versus that, you know, it's a little bit of a, I don't know. But otherwise, I saw you kind of reacting.
We are the DEC. We manage the hunting and fishing in this state, yeah. And the population control. It's a viable population control, and deer population are one of the most critical ones that we have to manage.
Fred has converted me. I've always rooted for the prey. I guess I have to root for the predator. Healthy ecosystems are, it's fair.
Yeah, that's good, Fred. I'm going to remember that. That's good.
And it's true. It is one of the best ways to tell how the population is doing is look at your predators.
Let me get Andrew on the phone in Irondequoit. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hey, great show. To the lady whose husband is an ornithologist.
Yes.
Hi. Yeah, we've discovered over the years that birds don't read books, and a lot of times they do show up where they're not supposed to be. Because I'm a birder up here in Irondequoit, and that's what we've discovered over the years. Oh, and by the way, if you ever want to shoot live orioles, come up to Irondequoit in the summer. And they're in every single yard in Irondequoit. There's an oriole.
Lucky you.
I think my theory is, I've been watching these birds for years, I think they're stopping at the lake's edge and saying, you know, this is a nice little neighborhood. Why don't we just stay here for the summer instead of going off to Canada? Because it's like Irondequoit has orioles, and like Pittsburgh doesn't have very many. But Irondequoit, like every yard, there's an oriole in the summer.
Wow. Beautiful.
Thank you, Andrew. Birds don't really read books. It is true. That is, Andrew's observation is correct. And therefore, sometimes you get them where they're not supposed to be. And on the subject of things going where they're not supposed to go, sometimes that's climate related. Sometimes, nature is sort of adjusting to change. Here's a great comment from Steve Orr from the Democrat and Chronicle here in Rochester. Thanks for listening, Steve. He points us to the fact that the Democrat and Chronicle, and Steve has written about the lilac peak bloom. The bloom times at Highland Park, so our guests from out of town might not know that there's the Lilac Festival in May-ish, though it's getting earlier. And Steve says their story in December on this reported that since 1905, the peak bloom for lilacs is now 12 days earlier. Great data set there.
Yep.
Great research from a number of organizations and the Democrat and Chronicle. Steve, that's a really good data point there. So, yeah, if you perceive that aren't the lilacs always coming earlier, certainly they would be, depending on how long you've been alive and how many times you've been there. That is true. That's one of the changes that's happening and that we're seeing impacted directly. Well, we're down to our last couple of minutes with our guests from Nature. And Fred, this is the trite question, but I'm sure you get it all the time, but people want to know, and you've got viewers who want to know, what has excited you the most on the program, and what are you most excited to do next with Nature?
What has excited me the most on the series is a film we did a few years ago. It's my favorite film. It was called My Life as a Turkey. And it went on to win an Emmy. It won many awards. It was based on a book, and it came to my attention by a producer in England, of all places, because the whole thing took place in the United States. It was excerpted in The New Yorker, and it became our highest-selling DVD. Long story short, a researcher in Florida wanted to know what it would be like raising turkeys, wild turkeys, from poults, which are baby turkeys. And so they were developing the land, and he asked the developers to, instead of destroying the turkey eggs, bring them to him. And he imprinted these eggs, which means, if you don't know what imprinting is, when these little baby, when these chicks come out of their egg, the first thing they see, they think it's their mother. So if you're there and you're just watching them, and they come out of their egg and they see you, they will follow you. They will think you're their mother. And so for about 9 months, he was inseparable from these little turkey poults. And the things he observed and studied was absolutely extraordinary and phenomenal. For example, he would take them for walks in the woods, and they would come upon a tree stump that clearly had a very clean cut. You know, it wasn't a natural falling of a tree, but clearly it was clean cut from something. And the turkeys were completely baffled and bothered by it. It didn't look natural to them. So there were a number of observations this guy made. And by the way, he just looks like a rancher, and yet the words that came out of his mouth were absolutely poetic and wonderful. And anybody who's seen this film wasn't able to forget it. And it's those kind of stories, how we relate to nature and how nature affects our being and our souls, that really stick with me.
That's from Nature. And coming up here, April 29th to May 1st, American Spring Live, 20 seconds. What excites, what story stands out to you that you can't wait to tell for American Spring Live?
Bobcats, predator. We're going to try to film those live in Point Reyes National Park. There's just been a boom in bobcats.
Good luck with doing this on the live scale. And I know the team is going to be so ready. WXXI-TV, April 29th to May 1st, American Spring Live. Tonight's event at the Little Theater, sadly sold out. But Betsy Youkiritis from the DEC, the New York State DEC, is working with us on a number of things. And you've been hearing her talk about that. If people want to get in touch, what's the best way to do that?
All of the events are on WXXI Kids Facebook page, as listed as Facebook events.
Awesome stuff. Please check it out. We have a wonderful community of viewers and friends across the area. Betsy, thanks for sharing on that. Nice to see you here. Thank you so much.
It was fun. Thanks.
Ann Johnson Prum, senior producer of American Spring Live, thank you so much for being here.
Pleasure.
And Fred Kaufman, executive producer of Nature. Thank you, Fred.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. Talk to you tomorrow.